The next case is 00-1911, Basic Distribution Corporation versus the Ohio Department of Taxation. Mr. Perry.
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, this is the first case ever filed under the Taxpayer Bill of Rights since it became effective in 1990. It is important to the ability of the tax commissioner to effectively enforce and administer the tax laws of the state and to the integrity of the special statutory proceedings established by the General Assembly for the review and resolution of legitimate tax disputes that arise in the course of assessments and refund claims, that the actions permitted under this Taxpayer Bill of Rights be limited to those expressly authorized by Section 5703.54.
Mr. Farron, this case seems to me like it's a little unusual for a tax case, because usually the facts are not so much an issue. This case is, it's like reading two different cases to read. The Court of Appeals opinion first, and your brief, and then the brief of the appellees. Do we have a good record in this case that we can determine who's right?
I believe you do have a good record, Your Honor, and I think you'll find the same great discrepancy if you read the Court of Claims decision and compare it to the Court of Appeals opinion. The findings are diametrically opposed, and I believe a review of the record will reveal that the Court of Claims decision, its findings and conclusions, are amply supported by the record, and conversely, the findings and conclusions by the Court of Appeals find no support in the record.
It seems that the Court of Appeals opinion, at least the author, I get the feeling that it's written sort of, this is the spirit of the law, and the board and the tax commissioner didn't follow the spirit of the law, and that you're asking us to look at the statute of it. The statute says that there have to be violations of statute or regulations of the commissioner, and that it does appear that some of the things that the Court of Appeals said are not found in the statute. I mean, the kind of paper used and that sort of thing is so off.
I think that's essentially correct, Chief Justice Moyer. But in addition, I think the Court of Appeals statements and findings with respect to what was done and what it believes was fair totally ignores the evidence in the record. The department disagrees strongly with any suggestion in the Court of Appeals opinion that its agent conducted itself in an unfair manner.
Had you do that you didn't do? I had the same problem that the Chief just spoke about. It seems like two different cases. You say all through your brief meticulously how you bent over backwards to do things you didn't even have to do.
Your Honor, I've seen an awful lot of audits and assessments, and the agent in this case, in my opinion, conducted herself clearly in accordance with all of the provisions, procedures, and so forth, and in fact went beyond what she was required to do in several areas. One of the areas that the Court of Appeals attacks the department and the agent for is its statement that in reviewing the letters of usage that Basic Distribution received from its customers, that's a situation where if you don't get exemption certificates, you have to go to your customer and get a letter stating that it was used for a specific purpose to see whether it was exempt from taxation. They didn't have valid exemption certificates. They were required to get these letters of usage. The Court of Appeals states that the agent refused to assist them in sending out the letter requesting these letters of usage and refused to review the letters of usage as they came in. The Court of Claims found just the opposite. The Court of Claims found that the agent did review those letters of usage as they came in with Basic Distribution and in fact even assisted them in getting information from their customers. The agent would actually call customers up to get additional information. The record is replete with evidence.
Didn't she even assist them in preparing the letter?
She assisted them in preparing the letter that went out. She gave them samples of letters that went out. As soon as the letters of usage were coming back in, the agent went to Basic Distribution's offices and reviewed those letters and even suggested changes in the letter they sent out to get more complete information.
So the question is, what should you have done that you didn't do?
I don't think...
What are they arguing? Because I had trouble getting them.
I have a great deal of difficulty understanding what they're arguing. I believe they just made basic statements that are unsupported by anything in the record. And that's one aspect in which the department asserts that the Court of Appeals erred. It failed to give due deference to the findings and conclusions of the Court of Claims. And as this court held in Myers and the Fabe case, both of which are cited in our list of additional authorities, it is error for a Court of Appeals to substitute its judgment for the findings and conclusions of the trial court if those findings and conclusions are supported by some competent and credible evidence. In this case, there's much more than that in the record to support the Court of Claims findings. And conversely, there is virtually nothing in the record to support the findings and statements contained in the Court of Appeals opinion. In fact, if you compare the statements and the conclusions in the Court of Appeals opinion with the complaint filed in this case, frankly, it appears that most of those findings and statements and conclusions were lifted directly from the complaint. If you compare the conclusions of the Court of Appeals at page 15 of its opinion with the allegations contained in the complaint at paragraph 38, A through H, it appears that they were taken almost verbatim from the complaint. The cases have to be decided on the facts and the record, not on allegations in the complaint. I believe if you review each of those areas where the Court of Appeals claimed that the agent or the department frivolously disregarded standard procedures, you will find that the record does not support one of those. And conversely, the record actually supports each of the findings and conclusions by the Court of Claims, which found, based on its review of the evidence, that the agent and department acted in accordance with existing law and that they did not frivolously disregard any provision of Chapter 5739. The more fundamental error committed by the court, however, is its failure to apply the clear language of 5703.54. It applied the wrong legal standard. After listing the various acts or omissions which it claimed were made by the department, the Court of Appeals stated that these frivolously disregarded standard procedures. It didn't go on to explain or even identify what these standard procedures were. But more importantly, that statement ignores the plain language of Revised Code Section 5703.54. That statute provides a very narrow cause of action. It provides that a taxpayer aggrieved by an action or omission of an agent or officer of the Department of Taxation may have a cause of action for damages if, in the action or omission, the officer, if in the action or omission, the agent or employee frivolously disregarded a specific provision in one of the five designated chapters in that particular statute. With respect to a sales tax audit and assessment, the only relevant chapter would be Chapter 5739 of the Revised Code. It also requires that the action or omission occurred with respect to an audit or assessment of the taxpayer. It doesn't apply to actions, for instance, with respect to refund claims filed by taxpayers, which among the actions or omissions referenced in the Court of Appeals decision and those asserted by Basic in this case include actions or omissions it claimed were made in the refund proceedings that were filed by Basic Distribution after it had been assessed and failed to petition the assessment. I'd also note that after it filed a refund claim, the department or the tax commissioner issued a final determination, and Basic Distribution intentionally chose not to appeal that final determination, even though it had the right to and was fully aware that it had the right to do it. Rather, it filed the underlying action in the Court of Claims, claiming that in the course of conducting the audit and in issuing the assessment and in the course of the refund proceedings, the agent and or the department frivolously disregarded various provisions of Chapter 5739. However, while they make a general assertion that the officer, the agent, or the department itself violated provisions of Chapter 5739 in conducting the audit and in issuing the assessment, it failed to identify any specific provisions which it claimed were frivolously disregarded, with only two exceptions. One exception is its claim that in conducting a sample audit and in projecting the results of the sample audit to the entire audit period, the department acted contrary to Revised Code Section 5739.13. But that's plainly wrong. As this court held in Akron Home Medical Services, Revised Code Section 5739.13A expressly authorizes the tax commissioner to conduct sample audits. The court further held that where a taxpayer agrees in writing to the use of a sample audit, as did Basic in this case, the taxpayer waives any objection to the use of that sample audit. The claim that the commissioner committed some erroneous act in projecting the results of that sample to the entire audit period is simply illogical. That's the whole purpose of a sample audit. You review a sample period within the entire audit period, and then you extrapolate your results throughout the entire audit period. And furthermore, the written agreement expressly provides that it would be applied to the entire audit period.
From page 15 of the Court of Appeals opinion, upon which the taxpayer relies, the Court of Appeals also said there was a violation of point 13 that had the person who did the original audit do the second audit or to respond to the complaints from the taxpayer.
Chief Justice Moyer, the Court of Appeals actually didn't refer to any specific statute when he asserted that the department frivolously disregarded standard procedure by assigning the same agent to consider the refund claim that had conducted the audit. However, there is certainly no chapter or provision, there's no provision in Chapter 5739 that would prohibit that. Secondly, it just makes sense that the agent who is familiar with the operation would conduct the refund claim. Thirdly, as I indicated at the outset, 5703.54 is not applicable to alleged acts or omissions conducted in the course of a refund claim. Certainly, the Court of Appeals did not cite a single provision within Chapter 5739 that was violated, much less frivolously disregarded by that assignment, nor does Basic anywhere in its complaint or its argument reference any such provision or rule that would have been violated.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals on page 4 of its opinion, it talks about a cover letter. And a letter containing 48 legal-sized pages of audit work papers, spreadsheets, including untaxed sales by location during the test months, along with computation of tax owed. The cover letter accompanying the summary said no appeal can be made until you receive the formal notice of assessment. The summary did not identify which exemption certificates or letters of usage were disallowed, and it did not identify which catch sales by specific customers were taxable. Such information was necessary to effectively contest the results of the summary, and without it, BASIC could not challenge the assessment.
Your Honor, what that ignores is throughout the course of the audit, the agent gave BASIC Distribution the disallowed exemption certificates, explained the reasons they were disallowed. With respect to the letters of usage, the agent gave, obviously BASIC obtained the letters of usage, the agent went over those letters of usage with BASIC Distribution, told them which ones were allowed and disallowed, and explained the reasons. With respect to the cash sales issue, the court statement frankly makes no sense. The problem that BASIC had was it made cash sales and it had failed to identify the name of the purchaser on the cash sales. As a result, there was no way they could get exemption certificates or letters of usage. But that was their problem. They hadn't identified those customers. The department certainly couldn't identify them because it wasn't contained in any records of BASIC Distribution.
So this entire paragraph is just dead wrong?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And we would find that where in the record?
Well, what you would find throughout the record...
Do we have to rely on your representations, or is it in the record?
Well, isn't it in the Court of Claims decision?
It's
direct contradiction to what was in the Court of Appeals?
It's in the Court of Claims decision. It's also clearly in the record at pages 50 through 61 of the supplement, for instance, is the discussion with respect to what the agent did in reviewing and discussing the letters of usage with BASIC Distribution. With respect to the disallowed exemption certificates, at the transcript at pages 308 and 309 and pages 496 to 497, the agent went through everything that she did with respect to reviewing the exemption certificates. The exemption certificates themselves are in Exhibit 7 of the plaintiff's exhibits. It shows that they were all stamped disallowed, and it has the number indicating the reason why they were disallowed. A review of the refund claim filed by BASIC Distribution establishes that they were fully aware of which certificates and letters of usage were disallowed and why, because in their refund claim, they argued that the reason given by the department for disallowing them was erroneous. They must have had these certificates and letters of usage, and they must have known why, or else they couldn't have written that type of language in their refund claim. And the agent's remarks that were done shortly after the audit and before this litigation was begun, which I believe is found at page 86 and 7 of the supplement, confirms that she did perform these actions.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. Mr. Engel.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Mark Engel here on behalf of BASIC Distribution Corporation. With me at council table today, at my immediate right, is Mr. Andrew Kerr, the president and owner of BASIC, and to his right is Luther Liggett, my co-counsel in this case. I think that in looking at this particular case, the first two questions that the bench asked by both the Chief Justice and by Justice Douglas is, it looks like we have two different cases here. And I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding on the part of the state and on the part of the Court of Claims as to what was argued and what we're looking at here. It's one thing to say that the general audit procedures were followed. That is, were exemption certificates reviewed? Yes, they were. Was a 60-day letter issued? Yes, it was. Were letters of usage received? Yes, they were. Were those letters evaluated and accepted or rejected? Yes, they were. That's not the process, however, that we're looking at here today, and that's not the process with which BASIC disagrees. But if you look at Chapter 5739, it goes beyond that mere surface process. And that chapter has provisions as to how those things are supposed to happen. You don't just look at exemption certificates. You have to evaluate those exemption certificates and see what information is contained on those. You have to give a 60-day letter at the right time. You have to inform the taxpayer what sort of evidence can be introduced during a 60-day letter. How are those 60-day letters evaluated? What are we going to look for? What kind of material has to be in there? And that's where the shortcoming is in this case.
You're telling us that the trial court, I guess, and Mr. Farron's representation, that the agent worked with the folks from BASIC, agreed with the audit period, and went over the letters and tell them what are we looking for in an exemption letter, that's we won't find that in the record, or
you'll find the explanation by the agent who says, yes, I did these things. You'll find testimony from the other people that no, this didn't really happen. None of us were there with the audit, so it's hard to say how much detail the agent actually went into on this.
And then but if that's the case, you're telling us there's a factual dispute. Don't we have to defer to the trier of fact? We don't take cases just on factual disputes.
That's right. This court doesn't. But the Court of Appeals can review the record, can look at the weight of the evidence, and can look at that issue.
But can they judge credibility and absolutely disagree just on credibility? That's not their role either.
That's not what was done here, Your Honor. Respectfully, I submit, if you look at the trial court's decision, they did not discuss the legal provisions. They did not discuss the particular facts relating to those legal provisions. The first 7 or 8 pages of the Court of Appeals decision, it comes right out of the agent's remarks as to the general process, the first item that I talked about. But it doesn't say how the certificates were evaluated. It doesn't say how the letters of usage were evaluated. It doesn't say what the instructions were in terms of what the letters of usage had to be. That's the issue where there's a dispute, and the Court of Appeals said, trial court, you didn't look at that. You didn't make those findings. And if you look at the record as a whole, there's deficiencies here. There's clearly provisions that the agent ignored, and this was based on the agent's own testimony. If you look at the testimony that the agent provided here, she said, first of all, in evaluating certificates of exemption, there are 3 things that are required. You have to identify the purchaser. You have to reasonably apprise the tax commissioner of the basis of the exemption. And the certificate has to be signed and dated. That's part of the rule. That tells you whether you have a good certificate. But the agent also testified at great length that, first of all, with the Wolf decision that says if you have the date somewhere on the certificate, that's sufficient. Doesn't have to be by the signature line. The explanation was, we don't follow Wolf for any other taxpayer. That's the only reason given why it wasn't followed. These are certificates that were dated. It just wasn't at the position that the agent wanted it to be. There was also testimony about what sort of explanation might reasonably apprise the tax commissioner of the exemption claim. I think the most egregious example is the agent's insistence that a certificate had to state that the user was both charitable and nonprofit. If it only said charitable, that wasn't good enough. If it only said nonprofit,
but the state refuted your argument in that regard, in that nonprofits don't get tax exempts, only charitable. So if you said nonprofit, you may well fit under a category that was not tax exempt. How do you respond to that?
Your Honor, if you look at the decisions of this court that have interpreted how certificates are to be construed, the main one that we cited is the Chemitron case. At that time, the exemption for manufacturers required that the item be directly used to manufacture tangible personal property for sale. Tax department argued that in that case, various certificates didn't say directly used or didn't say manufactured for sale. And this court said, you don't have to mimic the statutory language. The purpose...
No, but you have to give what is your tax basis for exemption. And if you say nonprofit, and you don't fit in the category of charitable, you don't get an exemption. That's a very different argument than what you're arguing about the manufacturing.
Your Honor, I think you misunderstand what the purpose of the exemption certificate is. It's to apprise the commissioner of the exemption being claimed.
So now, if you just put nonprofit down, then it was the tax commissioner's duty to track down the other person and find out whether they were a charitable nonprofit or just a nonprofit? Is that what your position is?
Your Honor, first of all, if I can answer it this way, the statute says merely to apprise the commissioner. The statute also says that if the exemption is erroneously claimed, the commissioner's remedy is to go after the purchaser, not the seller. And this court has recognized in Zink Engravers and Chemitron that these certificates are filled out by lay people, not lawyers such as myself, not judges such as yourself,
but we're talking
but lay
about
people.
a frivolous disregard of the statute, not a mistake. That's not a frivolous disregard of the statute, is it, to require that or to reject the certificate because it says nonprofit and not... You don't get an exemption, as Justice Stratton is saying. That doesn't get you anything, does it? That's not a frivolous disregard of the statute.
Your Honor, we believe it is because the statute says it's frivolous if you ignore a provision and don't give a good faith reason that you can get there by either extending the law to that point, distinguishing it, or arguing for a reversal. The point for all of these items here, we've only talked about exemption certificates, but there are more. The point of all of these is the department didn't give us a reason for it. As I said, the most blatant one is Wolf Envelope. We're not going to follow that case.
The triggering event is ignoring. So it seemed to me that the argument you're making is that we need some specifics about what provision was ignored, and then reasons, you know, become important.
Right.
But specific provisions having been ignored is where I'm struggling to find that.
We listed several, beginning at page 9 of our brief, Your Honor, of specific provisions we felt were ignored. The exemption certificates was one of those. The letters of usage provision says the taxpayer has to present evidence to prove that the item is non-taxable. The agent in this case said the only thing we're going to accept is a letter of usage. That's all we will accept. You have to give us a letter from the customer that explains this. This court's never required that. The statute doesn't require it. The cases decided by this court don't require that.
What provision was disregarded?
What was disregarded was the provision of what is a valid letter of usage. And that, as it's been interpreted by this court.
Okay, how was that ignored when she said, I'll accept letters of usage?
The instructions that she gave them were that I will accept letters of usage, but I will only accept a letter signed by the taxpayer that says how it's used.
Okay,
that's
what
not
provision
what the
did you disregard in saying that?
573903B.
Says?
Which says that the taxpayer has an opportunity, I don't have it verbatim here, but
yeah.
It says they have an opportunity to prove that the transaction is not taxable by submitting additional evidence. Statute doesn't limit it to a letter. And in fact, in this case, before this court, in the Union Metal case, mm-hmm. It was admitted affidavits would work,
okay,
pictures might work.
I guess I'm still struggling with which, I mean, you may argue, and rightly so, that seems being a little too rigid or some such thing, but nevertheless, I guess we have to look for a disregard of a particular provision.
Mm-hmm. And the disregard, we believe, is this court's interpretation of what that provision means to get a letter of usage. When the agent specifically instructs the taxpayer that I'll only accept this piece of evidence, there's no basis for that. There's nothing in law that supports that. There's nothing in the rule that supports that. And this taxpayer, it was their first audit. They don't know better at this point. They're taking the agent's word. The agent said, I wanted to help them. They needed help. That's right. And I think
Is that in the record? She uses the phrase, I only will accept.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It's both in the agent's remarks and it's several times in her testimony, and I believe we have referenced that in the brief. I don't have the specific page here with me, but she said that's all we will accept. The letter that she sent, the 60-day letter, says we will only accept a statement from the taxpayer.
Why wouldn't that be the subject of appeal rather than fit the elements for this cause of action in frivolous disregard?
It fits this cause of action for this reason. First of all, we're not arguing in this case that those particular certificates should have come out necessarily and no tax. But what happens here is because the agent misinformed the taxpayer of what evidence was submitted there, it restricted this taxpayer's opportunity to gather the evidence that might have proved its case. It had to go out, it had to incur much time and effort in contacting its customers. Some customers won't respond. And this taxpayer, instead of maybe going out or pursuing it with a telephone call or going out and looking to see what it was, says, well, gee, if all I can get is a letter from the taxpayer or the customer, and the customer won't give me a taxpayer or won't give me the letter, then I don't have anything that I can submit. And that's really what the cause of action is. It's not following the provision to the detriment of the taxpayer. What might those damages be? Might be the time the employee spends trying to track down that information. Those types of things. That's what the cause of action relates to.
You know, Mr. Engel, as I read the, you make some good equity arguments, but again, it seems to me that this statute, this law was written to be fairly confined to, as I read it, it reads to me as if it was designed to sort of put a bridle around the auditors so that they don't violate the code or rules of the tax commissioner, that perhaps there were some auditors who were sort of going off on their own and clearly violating rules or provisions of disregarding chapters of the code, and that your argument seems to be that if the code is silent on an issue, that the auditor has to maybe look at Supreme Court and needs to know about Supreme Court cases or what? I mean, I'm
Your Honor,
still
I think,
stuck with this language in the
sure,
statute, I guess. That's my burden
sure.
here.
I think that when you look at the bare statutory language, obviously the law is not just what the General Assembly has enacted, but it's also as that language has been interpreted by various courts, whether it be this court, perhaps the Board of Tax Appeals, Court of Appeals, whatever those courts may be, that's what the law is. And if what you're suggesting is that the agent doesn't have to know that in conducting an audit, then I guess the question is, how can the agent do an audit? There's an issue of due process that does underlie this, that says that the law, as interpreted, has to be followed in these cases. And it's our position, it's BASIC's position in this case, that there were several instances to its detriment where this wasn't done.
Maybe our problem is we're having trouble getting our hands around what is the real issue or the real problem here. And having found that reading the briefs originally, I went to the CPA's brief. And that helped me not one iota, I might tell you. They talk about all the things that it was designed to do, and we ought to make sure everybody knows the rules, and the court should issue these directives saying everybody should read this and be aware of it. And I kept looking, but where's the beef? And finally they say, she reviewed all 1,500 exemption certificates, and that's bad. Why is that bad, number one, and why should we not require, their second point it seemed to me was, exhaustion of administrative revenue. Those are the two issues.
Sure. As far as the first issue goes, Your Honor, I really don't know. We did not have input on that brief, and I can't tell you why they argued what they did. With respect to the exhaustion of administrative remedies, I think, first of all, the trial court initially ruled that that didn't apply here, and yet in its decision said it did. The Court of Appeals, I think, rightly said it didn't, because this is a separate cause of action. If this cause of action doesn't mean that we look at the process, both the broad process of do we look at exemption certificates or not, but also how do we evaluate those certificates? If this is clearly a separate cause of action, if it isn't, it's meaningless. Why is it there? There's absolutely no purpose to this provision if we have to exhaust administrative remedies, because everything's already been addressed to the BTA or to the appellate court, and there's no reason to do this. This has to mean something. It has to mean more than simply going to the Board of Tax Appeals. It also has to mean more than simply the broad process of, did you look at exemption certificates? Sure they did. I can't imagine an audit that would be so egregious that somebody wouldn't look at any of the exemption certificates, or that somebody wouldn't look at direct pay permit letters.
Or look at too many?
Well, you know, if that's how many customers you have, BASIC tried to do what it was supposed to do. It tried to get a certificate from everybody. Now, if the department doesn't like those certificates, then yes, you're going to have to look at 1,500 exemption certificates and decide what's there. But under this cause of action, you have to look at that provision as the law's been interpreted. You have to do it fairly, and you have to give a reason if you're not going to follow it. Well, and that's the problem that we have here.
I have to take a little issue with your characterization that the whole concept of this cause of action is fairly or unfairly. It seemed that the General Assembly wanted to make it much more limited because they didn't want to have every tax case come up on the dotting I's and or the overly rigidity of a tax audit, an auditor. I mean, it really did say we're only going to look at the ones that frivolously disregarded a specific provision in Chapter 57.
Your Honor, I think you're right in the sense that the General Assembly only wants to get to those items that's frivolous. And what is frivolous is what they've said. If you ignore it without arguing, making a good faith argument to go beyond or to apply the laws that exist. And that's what we've tried to point out here is where the defect is in this particular case.
I'm not commenting on whether you have or not. But.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Farron, you've used your time, but 30 seconds.
Thank you. I believe what basic distribution has just argued shows what they're really trying to do is to relitigate the assessment and the refund claim. That is,
your argument seems to be, you seem to chastise them for failing to go to the Board of Tax Appeals and all of those things. Are these not independent?
Your Honor, they're independent if you look at what types of causes of action are authorized under 5703.54. It does not provide an alternate method of challenging the disputes over an assessment.
I understand, but it seems if it's an independent action, whether or not they went to the Board of the Tax Appeals on the merits would be almost not relevant except to the question of whether or not they were negligent during the audit period or something of that nature.
Your Honor, I think it's relevant given what BASIC is really attempting to do. They're not looking to the standard under 5703.54 that there's some frivolous disregard of a specific provision in Chapter 5739, and I still didn't hear Mr. Engel give us any specific provision. They are trying to attack specific decisions, factual determinations made during the course of the audit and the assessment. And I submit that is not what the General Assembly intended to be actionable under 5703.54. They don't want the Court of Claims to become a tax court.
I mean, in the independent action, in evaluating whether or not the actions of the department were appropriate or not, you have to look at those underlying legal questions and tax issues.
I agree, Your Honor, but it's the degree that's at issue. If you're simply, if this is just a regular dispute that should be handled through the administrative process using the expertise of the Board of Tax Appeals, then you go that route. If there's a clear frivolous disregard of a statute, they just totally acted contrary to, let's say, a decision of this court on a specific issue, and the officer, employee, or the department just totally ignored, refused to follow it. That's clearly a frivolous disregard, but I submit the General Assembly never intended the Court of Claims to become a tax court.
This statute was enacted when?
In 1990, effective January 1, 1990.
How many actions have been brought under it?
This is it.
This is it.
This is it.
So there's been one, and you don't like it very much.
I think it's clearly erroneous, Your Honor.
Frivolous.
I truly believe it's frivolous, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Fair.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.